Good morning. This is the Triangular Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, December the 19th, 2018. We start with the news section. Track marks. After a rough year filled with near-death experiences, light rail emerged, well, mostly unscathed. Just last week, the future of Durham-Orange light rail transit looked like a nail-biter. Some powerful downtown stakeholders had turned on the project, worried that GO Triangle's plans to close Blackwell Street to traffic would cut off the American Tobacco campus from the rest of downtown. That snag was also holding up needed agreements with Duke University and the rail company Norfolk Southern, both of which have concerns about how light rail would affect their own operations. Given light rail's tight timetable, any glitch could prove fatal for a project in which the region has already invested more than $100 million. So headed into the new year, its fate seemed uncertain. But then on Friday evening, GO Triangle proposed a solution, a last-minute alternative to closing Blackwell Street. It would dig a tunnel under downtown. Details need to be filled in, not the least of which is how much such an endeavor will add to light rail's $2.47 billion price tag. But if this link is indeed worked out, then light rail's prospects are considerably better now than they were at the beginning of 2018, when a leaked memo suggested that the Trump administration wanted to gut funding for these kinds of infrastructure projects. Instead, however, this year's federal spending bill actually increased funds for this type of grant that GO Triangle is seeking. And in the next Congress, U.S. Representative David Price, a Democrat and light rail proponent who represents Wake and Orange counties, will become chairman of the key House Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Appropriations Subcommittee, helping to secure the project's fortunes at the national level. Moreover, in November, North Carolina Democrats succeeded in breaking Republican supermajorities in both chambers of the General Assembly, foreclosing the Republicans' ability to further meddle with a project they clearly despise. Last year, the GOP nearly derailed the entire thing with a provision inserted behind closed doors into the state budget. Democratic legislators managed to get that language removed, but to do so, they had to agree to a new project deadline that gave GO Triangle only until November to secure a federal grant that will cover half of the project's costs. If GO Triangle fails, the state will pull its share of the funding. To get the federal grant in time to meet the state's deadline, GO Triangle must finish its application by April. The legislature also required the project to secure all of its non-state and non-federal funding by April 30th, including its fundraising efforts through the nonprofit GO Triangle Partners, which is tasked with raising $102.5 million in land and cash. With so much happening so close to those deadlines, there's a sense that major decisions are being made at the last minute. Orange County Commissioner Renee Price says that she's had to hear about developments like concerns raised by Duke University President Vincent Price about the rail alignment, departure from the GO Transit Partners, and the resignation of a sudden contractor who had come under scrutiny after a past felony conviction surfaced. And she learned from the news, rather from GO Triangle. Durham City Council member Dedreana Freeman also criticized the agency's communications during a public hearing earlier this month to rezone property for a rail operations and maintenance facility. Several residents around the state said they had little information about what the facility will mean for their neighborhoods, other than a noise study by GO Triangle released in October, and walked back that night. Unexpected changes to the project are making it less and less appealing to the point where people who are proponents of light rail are standing in opposition, Freeman said to them. In the past, they've done a really good job of being active proponents for whatever they were working on. But for the light rail, I don't know if they just fell asleep, she told the Indy. It's a lot easier when the rules change for people to stay on board if they know who is making the decisions and how. Right now, it's all in a vacuum of a lot of conversations no one else will hear. This late in the game, however, there's little time for prolonged public debate. Because of the legislature's deadline, Go Triangle can't go back to the drawing board, says State Senator Floyd McKissick, who helped revive the project during last summer's budget debacle. Changes? Absolutely. Modifications? Yes. Refinements? Yes. Major re-engineering decisions? Not on the timeline we're on today. The idea of closing Blackwell Street to traffic and installing a signature civic space came as a surprise even to those close to the project and drew consternation from the likes of American Tobacco, the Durham Bulls, and the Durham Performing Arts Center, as well as downtown Durham Incorporated. Go Triangle's proposal was cited by two people who resigned from the board of Go Transit Partners, Brad Breiniger, chairman of the advertising firm McKinney, which has an office on Blackwell Street, and Michael Goodman, an executive at Capital Broadcasting Company, which owns WARL, the American Tobacco Campus, and the Durham Bulls. Goodman declined to be interviewed for this story. While the possibility of bifurcating downtown Central Business District from the American Tobacco area has been raised before, the need to close the Blackwell Street rail crossing wasn't discovered until about halfway through the design process, says Jeff Mann, Go Triangle's president and CEO. Any time you develop major infrastructure through an urbanized area like downtown Durham, there will be impacts, said Mann. We very much would have liked to have known earlier in the process that that would have been required. We gathered 50 downtown stakeholders together on Thursday, and there was strong support in this group for the tunnel taking the light rail under Blackwell and Magnum Streets, Durham Mayor Steve Shule said in a Go Triangle statement on the proposal. We'll be incurring significant costs with this solution, but it will allow us to get the light rail built, and that's crucial for our region over the next 100 years. How significant will those costs be? Initial estimates weren't available by press time, but Wendy Jacobs, chairwoman of the Durham County Board of Commissioners, says the $20 million budget for the proposed civic space can go toward the tunnel. That's probably a drop in the bucket. According to the January article in City Lab, a mile of underground rail in Seattle cost $600 million. In Los Angeles, it's $900 million. If the tunnel is deemed feasible, it would help Go Triangle finalize agreements with Norfolk Southern and Duke, which was worried about how the project would affect downtown. In another effort to appease Duke, Go Triangle has also agreed to elevate the line along Irwin Road in order to preserve vehicle access and utility service to Duke Hospital. But according to a letter last month from Price, the university isn't convinced that light rail won't disrupt its medical facilities. For example, Duke wants to be sure vibration from the construction or the trains won't interfere with procedures at the eye clinic, though Go Triangle says it has identified no vibration impacts on the line. Go Triangle is seeking a property donation from Duke worth $16.5 million. And Duke has agreed to work with the agency toward finalizing an agreement for the donation by year's end. While conversations with Duke have been productive, Mann says, it's unlikely Go Triangle will get an agreement with Norfolk Southern, which doesn't want its trains to share crossing protection systems with light rail at six downtown crossings, including Blackwell, or a lease agreement from the North Carolina Railroad Company, which owns the rail tracks downtown by the end of the year. The Federal Transit Administration, from which Go Triangle is seeking the federal grant, wanted Go Triangle to secure those agreements before 2019 to stay on track with its grant applications. All of this uncertainty could do more than generate anxiety. It could also have affected how light rail performed at a risk assessment the FDA recently conducted. The assessment, conducted from November the 27th to the 30th, included a review of risks the project may face, the likelihood of those risks occurring, and how they would affect the project schedule. The greater the risk, the more the project needs to stash away in contingency funding, perhaps more than the 20% built into current project cut of costs. Durham City and County staffers are working with Go Triangle to look for money in case of a shortfall. Orange County commissioners have said they won't kick in any more funds, like a higher contingency. There could also be problems on the fundraising side. According to an October 24th project update presented to Go Triangle Board of Trustees, these unresolved matters have also slowed Go Transit Partners' fundraising, and that was before the high-profile departures from the nonprofit's board. Thus far, Go Transit Partners has only raised about $14.5 million, meaning it has another $88 million to go by April the 30th. Duke's donation would more than double what they've taken in. Donations can also be made in exchange for naming rights to stations and the line itself. With Duke's support and property commitment, Go Transit Partners remains optimistic about completing their fundraising goal, says Go Triangle spokesman Mike Carbonell. So, with 2019 right around the corner, what do light rail's chances look like? McKissick said he's cautiously optimistic. David Price said he's confident federal funding will be there if the DOLRT makes the FTA's cut, no matter how budget negotiations go over the next few weeks. Renee Price, the Orange County Commissioner, still has concerns about the project's cost and whether it will serve residents who truly need mass transit. Regardless, though, she believes light rail is coming. When you hear that G.K. Butterfield and David Price, both of our congressmen, are behind it, she says, and you've got the mayors of the two cities behind it as well as the town council, the city council, as well as the commissioners, there's a lot of political will for this to go forward. And when you consider the millions of dollars that are spent every month personally, I hope they can figure something out. The next news article, Return to Crooked Creek. A Way commissioner wants to revisit one of the year's most contentious votes. Among the biggest flashpoints of this year's Wake County elections was the Board of Commissioners' decision last November to explore acquiring the former Crooked Creek Golf Course in Fuquay-Varina and turn it into a park. Critics argued that commissioners couldn't justify spending millions of dollars on the project after they declined to give the school system all of the funding it said it needed. In May, two commissioners, John Burns and Herb Portman, lost their Democratic primaries following races in which the Crooked Creek vote featured heavily. A month later, the Board of Commissioners voted 4-3 to buy the land for $4 million anyway, with Burns and Portman in favor. In December, the new board was sworn in. Burns and Portman were gone, replaced by Susan Evans and Vicki Adamson, and Greg Ford, a former school principal who is among the park's biggest critics, now thinks he has the vote to correct what he views as the previous board's mistake. On January 7th, he'll ask his fellow commissioners to put the Crooked Creek property back up for sale, possibly to the highest bidder, who could be a developer. In the last week, the residents who lobbied the county to buy Crooked Creek have deluged commissioners' inboxes with hundreds of emails to support for the park, some slamming Ford's move as reprehensible. To soften the blow, Ford wants the county to prioritize Southeast Wake County Park, a 300-acre project adjacent to Garner and Few Cave Arena, according to an email he sent County Manager David Ellis last week. Commissioner Sig Hutchinson, a Crooked Creek Park supporter, says he first learned about Ford's intentions on Thursday night when Ford left him a voicemail. "I've met with staff on this," Ford said. Board majority is with this." "It's political payback," Hutchinson said. "He lost the votes in November 2017 and in June, and now he feels he has the votes to turn it around. And so he's going to take this unprecedented move to basically turn 140 acres of park in the middle of the neighborhood into a residential development." The county's purchasing agreement mandates that the land only be developed for public use. Before that, though, the property was governed by homeowners association covenants that restricted its development to low-density residential housing. Here's where things get complicated. County guidelines require Wake to first offer the land to the school system and then assess its feasibility for affordable housing before putting it on the market. If it's sold on the market, however, it's possible that the sale would void the county's agreement and reestablish the HOA's rules, which, in turn, would ensure a housing development. The county attorney handling the matter could not be reached for comment. "This is Wake County parkland," Hutchinson said. "Why in the world would anybody in their right mind sell parkland to build houses?" Crooked Creek's neighbors have fought that possibility for years. In 2015, they sued the defunct golf course when its owners tried to build housing on the site. When they took their case to Wake County, showing up to public hearings in the hundreds to make their case for a park, they dropped their lawsuit under the county and when the county bought the land. In their eyes, Ford is acting out of spite, and they're going to pay the price. Ford says that's not the case at all. "Now that we as a new board have all been sworn in, I think the timing is perfect to look at where our priorities are, and that includes a review of current, existing, and future projects. Crooked Creek is one of those." It seemed to be a natural conclusion that the first thing we needed to do as a new board was to have conversations about whether or not this particular project idea was one that we still were behind. While Evans and Adamsons were the beneficiaries of a well-financed campaign by Dean Dedman, whose mailer accused Crooked Creek supporting commissioners Hutchinson, Burns, Portman, and Matt Calabria of wanting to spend $23 million to bail out a failing golf course, Adamson said she hasn't taken a position on the issue. "I will be looking fully into this matter, and I assure you that I will not be making any uninformed decisions." Evans could not be reached for comment by press time, but she told the News and Observer that she, too, had more research to do. Ford needs one of their votes to sell the property. Calabria, a chief proponent of the park's acquisition, argues that Crooked Creek is a symbolic issue in the education debate, saying there's never been a real conflict between preserving open space and the county's other priorities. He also points out that the county's voters approved a $120 million bond for parks and greenways in November. "We shouldn't be auctioning off one of our greatest amenities," Calabria said. "Residents across the county have made it clear that we value our parks and greenways, and getting rid of the property is a step backward that would harm southern Wake County and Wake County as a whole." Now this week's feature article, Born in Blood. Twice this year, Maya Little has faced charges over her Silent Sam activism. She's not done yet. The August 20th toppling of Silent Sam was a year-defining moment for the University of Northern California, Carolina at Chapel Hill. Students, faculty, and activists celebrated the fall of a 105-year-old monument to white supremacy, calling it a shining moment in UNC's history. Their celebrations were short-lived. Hours after the statue came down, UNC Chancellor Carol Folt condemned the action as unlawful and dangerous. Neo-Confederate and white supremacist groups descended on UNC's campus to mourn our fallen boy soldier, each time met by far larger crowds of counter-protesters. A series of tense confrontations with police led to the imposition of a November 15th deadline, eventually pushed into December, for Folt and UNC's Board of Trustees to create a long-term plan for the monument and submit it to the system's Board of Governors for approval. On December 3rd, they released their proposal for a $5.3 million History and Education Center to house Silent Sam on campus. Buried in the plan's appendices was a call for a $2 million a year mobile force of system-wide police, apparently to crack down on protests. Anti-racists denounced the proposed building as a thinly veiled shrine to Silent Sam. Hours after the plan's unveiling, hundreds assembled for a march through Chapel Hill calling for its rejection. The following week saw pledges from students and alumni to withhold donations, a petition from nearly 200 current and former student athletes expressing outrage, and a strike that saw thousands of teachers' assistants promise to withhold grades until the Board of Governors rejected the plan. On Friday, the Board of Governors did just that, sort of. More precisely, it punted, tasking the Committee on University Governance with developing a new recommendation by March 15. If that committee recommends anything other than permanently removing Silent Sam, its report will almost certainly be greeted by a new round of demonstrations, and by a little will almost certainly be in the midst of them. Little was a regular face during the spring semester's round-the-clock sit-in at the statue's base, but she first burst into the public consciousness in April, when she covered the statue in a mixture of red paint and her own blood, an act for which law enforcement and UNC officials slapped her with vandalism charges and University Honor Code violations. In October, the Honor Court found Lily guilty on a 3-2 vote and sentenced her to 18 hours of community service. That she is appealing, in part, because one of the guilty votes came from a campus conservative leader who had called Silent Sam protesters petulant children. Earlier this month, after the protest that followed the Board of Trustees' proposal, she was charged again with inciting a riot and insulting an officer. Yet Little remains undaunted, determined to continue fighting against what she views as the university's tolerance of white supremacy. Last Wednesday, 2 days before the Board of Governors rejected the Board of Trustees' proposal, Little spoke with the Indy about what Sam's toppling means to the UNC community, what made BOT's plan so dangerous, and why the anti-racism movement that's emerged in the wake of the statue's fall is here to stay. The Indy asked, "Tell us about April 30th. The day you first rode to promise as an activist." She responded, "I had been involved in protest around Silent Sam since August of 2017, when the sit-in started. What I saw myself doing was something that I was employed by the university to do and given admission as a grad student to do, to provide service to the university through educating and through reviewing and teaching history. All we wanted to do was show that within this monument's history and within its current representation, it represents white supremacy, and it has no place on this campus. At every end, we were met with resistance by the administration, whether in petitions and passing out information around the monument or in having signs and banners. On April 30th, I was continuing to do that again. I was employed to do this, to teach, to provide the historical context that this university refuses to do, to have an armed Confederate monument on this campus facing north toward Chapel Hill's historically black neighborhood, without what the Confederacy and white supremacy were covered in and built on, which is black agony and black blood and exploitation, is historically inaccurate. Then he said, "So you covered the statue with a mixture of red paint and your own blood?" She said, "Yes." "You call it a contextualization," Silent Sam. "What's the context you wanted to add?" She answered, "What we wanted to add and what we've been trying to add and what students have been trying to add since 1968, since black students have been at UNC, is that Silent Sam is a representation of white supremacy. The cause that the Confederacy advanced, the cause that Silent Sam's builders and dedicates advanced, was white supremacy and the enslavement of black people. And they actually continued the exploitation of black people during Jim Crow and today." The history of Silent Sam didn't end in 1865, when many of the young men who served the Confederacy from UNC, who were officers and who were by and large economically invested in the slave system, the Confederacy advanced, came back. It didn't end in 1895, which in North Carolina could be said to mark the end of Reconstruction. It didn't end with the murder supported by Julian Carr, one of the dedicators of the statue, of countless black politicians and journalists in Wilmington. And it hasn't ended today. UNC does everything in its power, spends money, uses its resources, and uses its police to protect a Confederate monument at the expense of the safety and dignity of its students. The Indy then said, "What was the response?" She answered, "The response from UNC was expected. It takes the university 105 years to do anything about a Confederate monument, and in fact, they didn't do anything about it. Students and the community members took it upon themselves to remove the monument, but it takes them 3 minutes to arrest me and have a facilities crew on campus clean up the monument because, God forbid, anyone see a Confederate soldier covered in blood. I was given a criminal charge, vandalism of a public monument, and the university also pursued honor code charges against me. In the terms of the community response, there's been so much support because there's been so much activism in this area. One thing that the university is trying to do in order to keep such a clean, well-kept monument and in silencing dissent is to negate the fact that there are so many people who don't want this monument on campus, who are sick of paying their tuition and student fees and taxpayer dollars to this monument, and sick of UNC's white supremacy. They're sick of UNC beating protesters and students and exploiting its workers. A lot of what's built up this year, and I would say these past 50 years, of black student activism in UNC is an anti-racist community that's willing to stand up when the university refuses to." Then he said, "What was your experience on August 20th when Silent Sam came down?" She answered, "I went to give a speech at the Peace and Justice Plaza right across from Silent Sam. Many other students gave a speech. Many black students and community members and people who have felt not only humiliation, but have felt unsafe because the university wants to protect a racist statue instead of them. They spoke and talked about that pain. What people saw happen was the community standing up to defend itself and keep white supremacy out of it when the university has done nothing. That day was one of the only days at UNC I've ever felt like I belonged here, and that there were people who cared about my safety and who cared about stopping white supremacy at UNC. The people who opposed that were UNC police, Chapel Hill police, some local white supremacists, and eventually the university. UNC has condemned people in its own community, students and faculty and workers and people within Chapel Hill, as outside agitators. That kind of rhetoric is not unfamiliar when it comes to civil disobedience against racism. A lot of times, people who have taken it upon themselves to serve their moral obligation rather than to serve a racist system have been called outside agitators. As someone who studies history, this kind of rhetoric is particularly dangerous. In times of extreme repression toward demonstrators and people who are struggling for their rights to their lives, people in power calling them outside agitators have given room for people to believe that. If violence is done to these people who are advocating for justice, but whom we call outside agitators, well, then that's okay, because they're not one of us, and they don't belong. The Indy went on. As university officials have debated what to do with Silent Sam, many people have argued that it poses a safety hazard. Now, why is that? She responded, "The only people who seem to deny that would be the university. It's an impossible for the university to deny that it's a safety hazard. It's a public safety hazard when they have police stationed around the monument and continue to have them stationed around the pedestal 24/7 at all times. In fact, the university since spent $400,000 just last year in security for the monument. And not only security for the monument, but police to violently assault and harass anti-racist protesters. And when anti-racist activists and students talk about the monument as a public safety hazard, what we're saying is that these monuments have always been supported by people who support white supremacy, and more so now. They become beacons for white supremacist groups to do violence and to harm to communities that these monuments are placed in. We've seen that at UNC. We've seen white supremacist groups come to UNC to display hate symbols like the Confederate flag, to threaten students, to threaten community members, and to make UNC a visible space of white supremacy. And what we've seen also is the police and administration supporting that by not only tacitly giving these people a space to rally for white supremacy, but also by beating protesters, pepper-spraying protesters, and silencing all dissent." Then he next asked, "How hard has it been to keep these demonstrators going in the face of opposition from administrators and police officers?" She answered, "From trying to make it impossible by using physical violence on us and by making arrests and issuing no trespass orders, I remember at the August 30 protests where people were directly pepper sprayed and had nowhere to go. The police had no idea what to do, and the only reason some people who had been directly pepper sprayed were able to see and get out of that space was because of anti-racist medics who were in the area and gave people salves to put in their eyes and on their noses and in their faces. Later that night, the police arrested three medics and issued them no trespass orders for campus. In the wake of my arrest last Monday, that's the same thing that happened. First, what happens is this physical violence, the use of pepper spray and of chemical weapons that are not allowed in war, the beating, the punching. And then comes the arrest on charges like assaulting an officer or incitement to riot. And I mean, these charges become things that are ridiculous. It's like, you got blood on my uniform. You assaulted me. Or, for incitement to riot, when I choked you, that scared people, so that caused a riot. These are the kind of charges that we get. And then what happens after people get those charges and have to fight an expensive legal battle just for being present at a protest against racism is that we're issued no trespass orders for campus. In my arrest, the officer who was alleged that I assaulted him personally came to Hillsborough during my surrender to deliver a letter of trespass from UNC police. So, as an employee and a student at UMC, I'm not allowed to go to McCorkle Place where many of the buildings in which I've worked in the past are indefinitely. If my charges are dropped, I'm still not able to go there. It's up to the chief of police to decide. So imagine that's happened to almost every single anti-racist activist who has been arrested on McCorkle Place. To me, it's obvious that only people UNC wants on McCorkle Place are white supremacists and police, because those are the only people who are given license to physically assault and then ban people from campus. Then he went on, what are your thoughts on the Board of Trustees' proposal for Silent Sam? What about the community's response? She answered, this idea of an education center is completely false. It's a shrine to white supremacy. It is the re-erection, the UNC being the only university in 2019 that will erect a Confederate monument and build a shrine around it that is specifically designed so that no one will protest at it. It is not contextualized at all. The only context that will be provided is by the university, which has failed for the last 105 years to do anything. And this will be built in South Campus, which is today because the university is still very segregated in its housing, where the majority of the black students will go to UNC, where they live. It's also a five-minute walk from a synagogue. The university decided to build the shrine that these people rally around next to a synagogue, next to black students. Not only that, not only do you have that total indignity to us, and to make us pay for that, too, but then you have the creation of a police force specifically to squash dissent. The day after the proposal was announced, there was a huge rally at the Peace and Justice Plaza, and hundreds of protesters were there. I announced during the rally the teachers' assistants faculty strike. What the university has told us throughout this year, and is clear telling us in this proposal, is that it doesn't care about a safe and equal working environment for us. It doesn't care about our students. Asking our students to study, to work, to live in this environment in which they are not protected, in which they are not valued, is contrary to our mission as educators, is contrary to what we want to provide to students. We're not going to perpetuate white supremacy onto our students. We're not going to perpetuate their exploitation and the university humiliating and disregarding their safety. That is why we're committing to strike, to withhold grades, and to not perpetuate the university's administration. What has been so strong throughout this year for me has been the support of the community who are tired of having this symbol of white supremacy in their community and on a campus where they visit or work or study. And that's exactly what we've needed. The only thing that made the university listen has gotten them to do anything and has made any change in the landscape of UNC has been direct action, has been refusing to cooperate with the administration. And that's going to continue until the administration decides to work with its students and its workers and the university and the community around it. Finally, he said, what do people need to know about this community that sprung up? She answered, the people in this community are taking it into their own hands with the law and the police and the university have not done for them. And that is protecting each other, making this an equitable and fair community, and making it a place in which people are not abused or afraid because of their race. That's why it's going to last, because that has affected real change. The creation of that community has strengthened so many people, and the university has proven itself to not be a part of that community. And so have the police. And so has the legal system in Orange County. The more people have seen that, the more people have seen the administration or city officials or police that are against them, the more they turn to direct action, to fight for themselves, and to fight for their equality. We now turn to the Indy food section. drinking solution. Local hospitality pros share tips and recipes for a spirit-free yet spirited holiday season. 'Tis the season for holiday parties. With work functions, family get-togethers, and your neighborhood ugly Christmas sweater party, it often seems that December is one non-stop rager. All that holiday cheer is often accompanied by all those holiday drinks, eggnog, punch, cocktails, glass after glass of wine. So it's little wonder that this month is usually when I'm going to take it easy on the booze pledges fall by the wayside. All those trying to abstain this time of year, or more importantly, for those who are in recovery, navigating a season of family obligations and never-ending parties can be particularly tricky. There is often strong social pressures to partake, and in a month that can dredge up a lot of feelings, both good and bad, each successive get-together can quickly turn into a minefield. According to the Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to addiction recovery, holiday customs, childhood memories, and annual gatherings that are closely associated with drug or alcohol use can tug at your emotions and put your recovery at risk. They cite financial stress, overcommitment, and family dynamics as just some of the many obstacles that these seekers to stay sober may face this month. So we reached out to local food and beverage pros to get their tips on how to best navigate the booze-soaked holiday season. Scott Crawford, chef owner of Raleigh's Crawford & Son, has himself been in recovery for years and is a strong advocate for those in the hospitality industry looking to get sober. In 2017, Crawford founded the Raleigh chapter of Ben's Friends, a support group that helps hospitality professionals struggling with substance abuse and addiction, and hold meeting at Crawford & Son every Sunday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 2 p.m. For me, the holidays bring a lot of stress and fatigue already, Crawford said. The idea of adding a bunch of alcohol to that, like I used to when I drank, is so unattractive to me at this point. Crawford recognized that holiday parties can be a particularly tricky situation. A host always feels obligated to get a drink into your hand, he says, but we're nervous about that awkward moment and whether we take the drink or turn it down. Crawford says that at parties, he tries to head off that uncomfortable moment by having a spirit-free drink in hand. I still love to go to parties and see people. I make sure I always have a refreshing beverage, even if that means I bring it. If you like a specific wine, you'll bring that to the party, so why not a specific spirit-free beverage? His go-to? Drinking vinegars, also known as shrubs, are sweetened vinegar-based syrups that bartenders rely on to bring concentrated flavors to cocktails and mocktails. Crawford buys vinegars from Linden Farms and mixes them with club soda and a citrus twist. Crawford also notes that there has been a rise in the popularity of low-alcohol cocktails and mocktails at bars and restaurants. At Crawford & Son, there are three spirit-free drinks on the menu, each crafted with the same attention to flavor as the cocktails. One, the Capital Bounce, is a refreshing ruby-hued libation that mingles cherry, hibiscus, cinnamon, and soda water that exudes holiday flair. And as the recipe shows, it's easy to make in big batches for the party. Brad Ferran, beverage director for the forthcoming Durham Food Hall, has also seen a shift toward alcohol-free drinks. As the personal health trend has gained steam over the past few years, there's been a decided rise in interest in non-alcoholic beverages, he said. People are still looking for unique flavor experiences, but maybe without all the extra calories and the headache in the morning. Ferran likes to lean on fresh lemonade with seltzer instead of still water for a quick, refreshing mocktail. You can make it jazzier by substituting tonic syrup or grenadine for sugar or simple syrup, he said. You can even take a step further and muddle some mint or fresh berries in it. At Durham's Alley 26, owner Shannon Healy always ensures he has an alcohol-free cocktail on the menu. When we're talking about drinks, many of the flavors come to us through sweet products. We balance sweet against bitter, sour, spicy, and boozy, he explains. With non-alcoholic drinks, we don't have the boozy, but making anything delicious means paying attention to balance. This season at Alley 26, Healy is offering a frozen almond horchata, a boozeless one-up on your typical nog, crafted with almond milk, cinnamon rice, and sugar. It's so tasty, you don't even miss the liquor. He also shares a recipe for a festive spirit-free cranberry rosemary punch that's easy to make and serves a crowd. For those of us who do not drink alcohol but are looking to offer support to friends and family who might not want to partake, Crawford offers a few final bits of advice. Do a little research on interesting and exciting spirit-free cocktails. For instance, hibiscus is a great ingredient for a spirit-free cocktail, Crawford said. Instead of asking people if they drink or don't drink, offer up a spirit-free drink alongside a cocktail. If the option for a boozeless drink is already on the table, you've eliminated any awkward moments. So, raise a mocktail to the holidays and know that, yes, it is possible to have a spirited and delicious spirit-free December and start to the new year. Also in the food section, loggerheads. Everyone's all IPA this, IPA that, but lagers are the new frontier for Triangle craft brewers. Over the last few years, aromatic and hop favored India Pale Ales, or IPAs, have dominated the craft beer market. For many beer drinkers, the hoppier, juicier, and hazier the APE, the better. By contrast, lagers are light and refreshing, more beer-flavored beer. Lagers please through the purity instead of the power. Think of it like Waffle House's scattered, smothered, and covered hash browns with hot sauce versus a naked poached egg at Poole's Diner. Unfortunately, mass-produced lagers like Budweiser, Pabst, and Miller have misled people to believe that lagers are bland and tasteless. But with a return to quality ingredients and dedication to craft breweries across the Triangle, they are proving that lagers are the next frontier in craft beer. Not only are there a lot of IPA drinkers wanting to take a break from drinking IPAs and turning to lagers, brewers want to take a break from brewing IPAs, says Shays McMurray, head brewer of Durham's Full Steam Brewery. For brewers who have been used to brewing IPAs over the past few years, getting into the lager game means you're trying to hone your craft a lot more. So what's taken so long? Well, ask any craft brewer which beer is the hardest to brew. Chances are the answer will be lagers. Two defining characteristics of a finished lager is that it is fermented cold and then stored for a prolonged period in a cool environment. The word lager comes from the German lagern, which means to store. And early Bavarian brewers stored their lagers in cold caves. Lagers also use a bottom-fermenting yeast as opposed to top-fermenting yeast used in making ales. That is why lagers are known for their clarity, since the yeast is working near the bottom during the cold-fermenting process and then allowed to fully settle during the cool storage period. All in all, a lager takes twice as long to produce than an ale. During the brewing process, temperature and time are the two key factors that make the process so challenging. Since lager yeast prefer cold temperature with little wiggle room for variations, and the lagering temperature and duration needs to be spot on, brewers need to approach the process with technical precision. There are four main ingredients in beer. Water is the heart, malt is the soul, yeast is the life, and hops are the spice. A fine lager will have no one ingredient outshine another. This is achieved by using light, subtle malts and balanced hops that don't pack a punch. Water that is soft and doesn't contain a high content of dissolved minerals. And a fermentation and storage process that is closely monitored in order to give the yeast the exacting environment that it needs. Many mistakes made in brewing an ale can be masked by bold flavors and hops. But in a lager, where hops must remain subtle, there's nowhere for mistakes to hide. If the malt used is too robust in color and flavor, the lager will be too dark and heavy. If the length and temperature of the storage, the lagering process, are not on the money, the beer will lose clarity and crispness, as those can only be achieved by letting the yeast fully settle, giving the beer a light, effervescent quality. When you pour a well-crafted lager in a glass, small, perfectly formed bubbles will confidently rise from the bottom of the glass, gliding to the light beer with little resistance from weighty malt, cloudy yeast, or heavy water. Excellent lagers from top-notch local breweries, who predominantly brew ales, including Full Steam Brewery's Paycheck Pilsner, which uses the Matuka and Sapphire hops in place of traditional Sox hops for a more citrusy kick, Raleigh Brewer's Moravian Rhapsody Czech Pilsner, which sticks to the traditional agreements, allowing the process to shine, and Bombshell Beer Company's H-Town Lager, whose quality ingredients and crisp light profile make it a gateway craft lager for those used to the mass-produced variety. But lagers aren't just a one-trick pony. Although light lagers and pilsners are the most common styles of lager, there is a vibrant range of aromas, flavors, and styles within the lager family. Depending on who you ask, there are 10 major beer styles in the lager family, ranging from light pale lagers to a nearly black Schwarzbier, the latter of which Mason Jar Lager Company brews. Mason Jar Lager Company, located in Fukuave Arena, focuses exclusively on lagers. There are currently 14 different lagers on tap in its tap room. When brewer David Hainish was approached by Mason Jar Tavern to help start Mason Jar Lager Company, he found the idea both intriguing and intimidating, owing to the exacting nature of the brewing and lagering process. But Mason Jar Lager Company's dedicated to a lager has paid off. Their Pull Tab Pilsner and Happy Place Golden Lager are two shining examples of what a well-crafted lager should taste like. Both beers took home medals at this year's NC Brewers Cup, a gold in the pale bitter European beer category for Pull Tab, and a silver in the pale multi European category for Happy Place. Pull Tab Pilsner strays from tradition by replacing the Sots hop most commonly used in Pilsners with the Simico hop, which is widely popular in the IPA world. Pull Tab is light and refreshing, and the Simcoe characteristics are citrusy and subtle, finding their place in perfect harmony with the malt. Happy Place Golden Lager is a Munich Helles style, named for the German word Helles, which means light, bright, or blonde. Not only are lagers the next frontier for Triangle Brewers, it's the next phase of exploration for beer drinkers, craft aficionados, and novices alike. Light up and get to know the not-so-wild world of lagers. It's a refreshing change of pace. Now, a brief look at the indie music section. Holidays for Heathens. Have a holly jolly Christmas with a more secular soundtrack. My kids keep asking for an Elf on the Shelf, and I keep saying no. If you're not familiar, it's a fairly recent Christmas gimmick. The idea is this. The Elf, which looks vaguely like a character from 1964's stop-motion Camp Fest, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, is supposed to sit untouched on some surface in the house, watching and reporting to Santa. I'm not the first to say this, of course, but the Elf on the Shelf phenomenon just plain normalizes surveillance, celebrates it even. When I say no, it's not just a monosyllabic denial. I say why. I don't believe they should behave ethically because someone's watching, but because it's the right thing to do. I believe every person can be their own highest moral authority. Look at the screen section now. Keep it Poppins. And now for something a little cheerier, a nostalgic Mary Poppins Returns. Emily Blunt is pleasantly prim and proper in Mary Poppins Returns. She cuts a nostalgic figure, capturing the wit, whimsy, and elocution of the eponymous nanny, from her parrot-like umbrella to her clipped spit spots and pish poshes. Blunt doesn't have Julie Andrews' vocal chops, but she can carry a tune. Pleasant and nostalgic are the watchwords of director Rob Marshall's gauzy, inconsequential sequel, which again evolves around Mary Poppins being a delightful deus ex machina who arrives to save the strange relationship between a fuzzy Banks patriarch and its Muppets. After 5 decades, it's a joy to finally revisit the world of Mary Poppins, but like a spoonful of sugar, it's a heady rush, and it soon gives way to a comedown that leaves you craving something a little more satisfying. We have an announcement here from the Indy that affects next week's broadcast. We're taking a week off. There will be no Indy on December 26th. This is not a cause for panic, nor does it portend our demise. Rather, it's an acquiescence to simple reality. We're not going to sell a lot of advertising for an issue that comes out the day after Christmas, so we decided to give our folks some time off. On January 2nd, we'll be back with the year in review. Until then, keep checking the website. So with that in mind, we'll take this opportunity to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, or sorry, until 2 weeks, goodbye, good night, and good morning.